little different today on a Wednesday. I'm going to take a look at something that's happening historically in basketball that just hasn't, we haven't had this kind of run before, but actually why it doesn't work. Mark Wahlberg on a new movie coming out, his career. I ask him about fear. It doesn't go well. And life advice. It's the Ryan Russillo podcast presented by FanDuel. Take a shot at betting the NBA with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Right now, you can check out the new and improved Parlay Hub. Filter by odds, sport, and bet type to easily find the most popular parlays and same-game parlays all on one page. Plus, start betting the Explore page and the Pulse and bet live same-game parlays for every NBA game. So download the app today and bet with FanDuel, official partner of the NBA. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com to learn more about the resources and helplines available. And listen to the end of the episode for additional details. Must be 21 and older and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com. This episode is brought to you by Arby's. I remember my first visit to Arby's. I went with my grandfather, fresh out of WWII. I reached for his hand. He declined my grasp. I was worried about the options. I said, I know they dominate the roast beef world, but is there going to be anything for me? And here's the thing. There is. Well, now is the chance to try Arby's and find your favorite sandwich. With a wide range of options, see for yourself that Arby's sells more than roast beef. Plus, for a limited time, Arby's Rewards members get one free sandwich with purchase every week in April, online only. Simply join Arby's Rewards and order ahead today. Order on the app or Arby's.com. I've talked about usage rate before on the show, and I was working on something here, and it's kind of a theory, and I think it's been proven, and it's a little nerdy, but I want to get into it because I think it's actually very important with what we're seeing in today's version of the NBA, where the best player during the regular season is getting the ball more than we've ever seen at any point in the history of this game. Now, just to remind everybody, without getting into all the math of what usage rate basically is, it's a player's field goal attempts, the free throw attempts, their turnovers, the team's total minutes, and then you divide that by the team's attempts and all these different things and team turnovers and the player's minutes into that. So basically, Russell Westbrook in his triple-double season is the highest usage rate we've ever seen in the history of the NBA, because if you watch those games, he had the ball in his hands as much as any player we've ever seen, all right? So I think it's pretty simple, and I'm going to run through some of these players. Now, what I mean by what it's doing to today's game, which I think sometimes, too, with a force of analytics behind it, because I've also said this, I don't think there's ever been a bigger gap between what we see in the regular season version of basketball, and the playoff version of basketball. But it's a pretty simple concept, right? Hey, this guy's the best player. Let's make sure he has the ball in his hands the entire time. I haven't always loved the Harden stuff, but at the same time, he's a terrific shooter. He's a really great passer. You have to defend him a certain way. He was great on those lobs when they would play with a big, when they were five out. He was tough to deal with because he's getting to the free throw line a ton. So I think if you're Daryl Morey in that front office, you're going, well, why would we be running different stuff where he doesn't have the ball in his hands? I think at the playoffs, it becomes a problem, because I also think as we go through some of these numbers, when you're very predictable as a team offensively, it's just easier to defend, because you become easier to defend when you're playing each other maybe 4 to 7 games in a playoff series. Now, let's look at what we've had happening here now recently. If you go through the last 10 years, 12 of the top 20 usage rates in NBA history have happened in just the last 10 years. Only two of the top 30 individual usage rate seasons have not been in the last 20 years. The only 90s season that I could find, I had to go all the way down to Michael Jordan in 92-93, and his usage rate, not the highest for him, but the only actual one that registered, was the 40th highest usage rate. So the highest usage rate from a 90s, the decade from 90s basketball player, was MJ, and that ranks 40th all time. We've had 10 top 20s in just the last 5 years. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, what does it mean for playoff success? Because if my theory is that I think that you can play this way in the regular season, put up huge numbers, get a couple MVPs out of this deal, I don't know that it's actually turned out to equal any kind of playoff success. And it's actually maybe a warning for one team. It could have been two, but we had a trade. All right, so let's run through it. The top usage rate season in NBA history is Westbrook in 16-17. They lost in 5 games in the first round. Harden, so this is 1 through 20. Harden, 18-19, they lost in the second round to Golden State. Kobe, 05-06, they lost in the first round to Phoenix. Westbrook, 14-15. Remember, KD only played 27 games that season. They didn't even make the playoffs. Michael Jordan, 86-87, first round sweep. Iverson, 01-02, lost in the first round. Giannis, 19-20, lost in the second round. Luka, 19-20, lost in the first round. Embiid, 21-22 season, so an active season here. We obviously don't know what they're going to do in the playoffs, but pre-Harden, as great as Embiid is, as much as I love watching this guy and that he may win an MVP that he's certainly deserving of, it wouldn't really mean much historically for playoff success. You wouldn't bet on that. DeMarcus Cousins follows him in 16-17 with a high usage rate season. He got traded that year and both of his teams missed the playoffs. Harden, 2019-20. They lost in the second round to the Lakers in five games. Dwayne Wade, 2008-2009, they lost in the first round. Jermaine O'Neal, 2004-05, lost in the second round. Harden, 17-18, Western Conference Finals. That's when they lost in seven games to Golden State. Michael Jordan, 2001-2002, missed the playoffs. Luka, 2020-21, another first-round loss. Those are those Clippers series. Iverson, this is the only one that made it to the finals. The 2001 season where they lost to the Lakers in the finals. Luka, 21-22. That's his active season right now. Iverson, 2005-2006, missed the playoffs. Kobe in 11-12, second round. So we have 20 seasons. Two are active. Embiid and Doncic now. Seven first-round exits. Five second-round exits. One Western Conference Finals. And one NBA Finals without Iverson. There's no real debate on this. It's a pretty damning trend. And it's something that we're seeing more often. Players having the ball in their hands more often during the regular season than at any other point. And there is nothing historically that tells you that this works out. The overall playoff record for these teams is 64-78. Now, you could argue, well, wait, they have high usage rates on these teams because the teams weren't that good. So what else were they going to do? That's true in some cases, but it's certainly not true for every one of these 20 teams that we had. I don't understand if you watch one person have the ball a historic level of time, that just becomes easier to defend. I don't know that anybody would playing against it would argue. Like, yes, this player's great, but if I know that he's the primary all the time and there's not a ton of ball movement, it's just somebody at the top deciding what they're going to do the entire time, then we can all shade towards that person because their tendency is that they've been playing this way for 6 months. The teammates have been playing this way for 6 months. And then all of a sudden have ball movement and people cutting like crazy. And now more people are taking shots in tighter spots, bigger pressure games. That doesn't really make a lot of sense if we didn't ask you to do that for 6 months. Let's take this further. Now, I also think historically we really dump on previous generations, but some of it's understood. I don't always have a perfect answer for how we should deal with historic numbers compared to the evolution of a player today. Many times I've argued with people or even players themselves that played in those eras about what today's game is versus the time that they played because basketball players are very protective. I think all people are, but basketball players to an extreme that doesn't really make any sense because the evolution of all athletes is proving that people are just better. We keep playing these sports. They get better at doing it. The shot making alone in today's game is absurd. But I'll also defend a previous generation, if you want to go way back decades, and say, okay, well, yes, people didn't make a lot of shots, and that led to a lot of rebounds. I mean, some of the numbers, right? Some of the numbers when you go back are nuts. The rebounding numbers are crazy. You're like, how did Wilt and Bill Russell average 23 rebounds a game for the playoffs? Like, how did that happen? Like, well, people brought the ball up, they played at a really fast pace, and they took a lot of shots, and they weren't that great at making them. I mean, Bob Cousy gets dumped on all the time because he never cracked 40%. I think he's like in the 30s for his entire career. I looked at it even further. If you go back and look at the field goal percentage leaders historically year by year, the first NBA season we had somebody lead the league at over 50% shooting was Wilt Chamberlain in 60-61. I mean, hell, there was a season in the 40s where the leading shooter in the league, the highest field goal percentage in the league was just under 35%. If you go look at 1969, and I'm just kind of picking out different stuff, the player who finished 10th in field goal percentage in 1969 shot it at 44%. If you looked at that today, LaMarcus Aldridge is that guy right now, 10th, he's at 56%. If you go through all the historical year-by-year stuff and look at the top 10, the 60s, 70s, it's littered with guys finishing in the top 10 that don't even crack 50%. That's impossible now. It doesn't happen. but it's just kind of the way that the game was played. So we could be both dismissive of it, but also understanding. And when I look at some of the single season numbers that we've had, all of these triple doubles, these guys putting up stuff we've never seen before. Remember, I was always joking how like I'd see some playoff number or, hey, this hasn't been done since Kareem, Wilt, and then it'd be Lou Dort. You're like, what the hell is going on here? I think you always have to look at it and go, okay, what was that era? Because when I look at the lack of success combined with the individual success, the statistical success, we could be years from looking back at what we're seeing right now going, yeah, that's when they just put the ball in one guy's hand the entire time. The guy put up huge numbers, won awards, but they didn't really do anything in the playoffs. Two teams out of the 18 that I have that are not active seasons, only two got out of the second round. Uncharted comes out February 18th. Some crazy backstory to this movie, and the star, Mark Wahlberg, joins us on the podcast. Before I get to all this stuff, kind of the obligatory Massachusetts to Massachusetts guy stuff, you've been out in LA a long time. I just moved here a few years ago. It's been a pretty incredible run by these teams. How do you deal with that, knowing that you just don't want to come straight out and tell what could potentially be a lot of your fans that you can't stand this run?
You know what? I wasn't mad that they won yesterday. We've had an unprecedented run. I mean, I was sitting there with Mr. Kraft yesterday, and it was like, it was so weird being at a Super Bowl and not having like the stress and the anxiety of, you know, the slight possibility that we may go home upset. But, you know, I was pulling for the Bengals. I love Joe Burrow, and I thought, you know, it's good for the league. It's good for small market teams. But I wasn't mad about them winning. That was certainly not the worst thing.
Yeah, see, I thought that was kind of the answer I'd expect. Is, you know, you just sit there and go, it's the Rams. Like, you're going to be that mad about it, right?
Yeah. All right. I love it. There's a bunch of guys that are on the team that I'm friendly with, too. So, what happened?
This movie is in development for 12 years, which, yes. If you know anything about Hollywood, you're like, yeah, it's about right. It's about average. The shift from this is that you originally were going to play the younger guy, and by the time this came to light, you had to change. How did this all go about?
It was crazy. And I was obviously blindsided by it a little bit. I was just, you know, not expecting that. I figured I had got a couple more good rounds left in me. But I get the call. Originally, we were supposed to do it right after the fighter, David or Russell and I. We had pitched an idea at Sony. So they were gung-ho about it. He turned in a script that they didn't want to make. So various directors came on board, and I was always kind of loosely attached. And then I get the phone call that they're going to make the movie. So I'm like, oh, cool. This is great. I'm like, who's the guy? Who's the other guy? And I figured, you know, maybe it would be Jack Nicholson or maybe get De Niro, who was originally attached when I was there. And they said, Tom Holland. I was like, I know Tom Holland. The kid, Tom Holland? And then, of course, it dawned on me that, yes, I have now transitioned into and aged up into the older guy. But, of course, right away, I thought, you know what? An advantage for me because he's going to have to do most of the heavy lifting when it comes to the stunts. I'm the kind of slick, savvy old guy who's basically barking orders and getting everybody to do all the heavy lifting for him. You know, so it was a plus for me.
You know, Holland's had a nice little run here because, you know, originally I was thinking about how I wanted to map out the questions I'd be like, did you pull him aside? You say, hey, but you get a few Spider-Mans under your belt. I don't know. Can he even be talked to anymore at this point?
Yeah, you know, he knows that he's successful, right? But he also knows that, you know, there's a long road ahead of him, and he's doing things that have big IP attached, and he wants to do small, smart acting pieces in between to kind of prove himself as a really strong dramatic actor and show his talents on that front. But, you know, he was definitely into the action because most of the Spider-Man stuff, you know, he's got the mask on. It could be one of any three doubles that they have. And he really wanted to show that it was him doing a lot of the stuff, which I found to be annoying because it's Saturday and I'm like, I don't care what action looks like. You know, I'm worried about the chemistry and the humor and the energy in the scene. But no, he's got his head on right for that much success that early on. He's in a good place.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I probably should have phrased that differently. If not that he's kind of like a jerk or anything like that.
No, it's all good.
But there's got to be moments where you kind of, you know, you've been around, you've done everything. you've done all these different genres, you've been incredibly successful, it's worked out, where you look at him going, you know, it's not entirely the same blueprint, but I don't know. Yeah. It just must be a weird kind of almost observation from your success to now see somebody in this next generation kind of like, hey, all these things are going to be in front of you, man, and trying to keep this thing going.
Yeah, yeah. And but we had many a talk about kind of the long haul, the marathon approach, as opposed to, you know, so much success comes so quickly, and that really becomes hard to maintain that. You know, you want a nice solid foundation underneath you. But he's definitely been very smart about the other choices that he makes. And he realizes that it's an opportunity to have that platform being Spider-Man to give him these other jobs and really showcase his talent. So I think he's gonna be good. He's grounded. He's also an athlete, and you know, he's cocky and confident, and he'll challenge you. And he's the pesky. It's weird for me because I'm the youngest of nine. I was always the younger brother, chomping at everybody's, you know, and nipping at their heels, and always trying to, you know, one up everybody. And so when he was doing that with me at first, I was like, wait a second, what's going on? And, you know, I was ready to kind of just be the mentor, but then I got it. And we actually really utilized that in the movie, and the chemistry is fantastic. You know, if you had a great script and lots of cool action and, you know, shots that you could put into the trailer that would intrigue people, but it's the chemistry that I think will really set the movie above, you know, what normal people expect.
Yeah, people love the video game. I mean, obsessed with it.
Yeah, it's been loved.
Right. Incredibly. Yeah. So it's a bit like, you know, the Marvel world's been around a lot longer, but when you are doing something creatively and taking this thing that people care about this much, how concerned are you with that challenge and how it plays out eventually?
Yeah, I mean, you definitely feel the responsibility to get it right. You've got the loyal diehard gamers who have, it's also because the game itself is very cinematic. It's great storytelling, but also the player is in control of the characters. It's theirs. They own it. And they, you know, they really feel like, oh my God, if you don't get it right, it's going to be a problem. So we were definitely focused on making sure that we did the characters justice for the diehard gamers. And we also wanted to attract an audience that might have never played the game and doesn't know that it's a video game, because it does lend itself to be adapted to the screen because it's so cinematic.
Were you ever close grabbing any of those Marvel bags? Because I'm worried about how many roles there are left for you.
No. I've always said, I was developing $6 billion man for a while. That was as close as I could get to doing the superhero thing. Guy who still wears normal clothes and, you know, just can, you know, do all those wish fulfilling things that all of us would want to be able to do, running faster, jumping, and having these powers. But I don't think I could walk out of the trailer with the cape and the spandex suit on. It's not really my thing. So I don't know. Maybe if a cool villain or something came along, but I've never been kind of in pursuit of something like that. Although I was up for, and I dodged the bullet with the role of Robin years ago when they did the Batman and Robin movie.
Was that Chris O'Donnell?
Yeah, Chris O'Donnell ended up playing the part. I was in talks with Joel Schumacher for a little bit, the filmmaker, but didn't pan out. So lucky for me.
Wait, so there's no regret is what you're saying? We can break that news now.
No. You know, I've been fortunate in that, you know, I mean, there were some parts that I could have played that I was attached to at one point that ended up becoming hits, but nothing like it was like, oh my God, if I only had done that in my whole entire career would have been different. So I've been fortunate that way.
Yeah. The reason I'd like you for a bunch of different reasons, but the thing that I've always admired is you do try a bunch of different stuff. Like I've seen interviews when you did Ted and you were talking to your wife and she was saying like, if this doesn't work, you know, sure. So what goes in, it's kind of like you were talking about with Holland, you're playing the long game here, but you probably have tried different things, not only just behind the scenes and everything else, but how do you kind of put it together? How do you figure out like, okay, I can try this, although this may be more risk here, but I know that I need to go back to some of the other stuff that everybody's expecting from me.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been kind of put in a little box, whatever it was at the time, you know, before I did comedy, people like, oh, he can only do action. Or I actually started more with dramatic roles after Boogie Nights and Basketball Diaries and roles like that and Fear. So it was like I was just kind of challenging myself and trying to defy the expectations of me, you know. So I always wanted to do something a little bit more challenging, a little bit more out of the box. And you know, always the complete opposite of last thing I did as well. You know, if I'm doing an action movie for 6 months and I'm like, okay, I don't want to do this anymore. I'd rather go do a comedy instead of room, you know, make myself and other people laugh. And then it's just about also kind of being older, embracing getting older, playing a dad, playing the elder statesman, all of those things. I always want to do something different.
All right. So you brought up my favorite, one of my favorite movies ever, and that's Fear.
That's good. You know,
first date with somebody, and they were like, he brought me to Fear. And so she wasn't super into that choice. But I've read something. Do you
Oddly
know this?
Enough, most, it's really, you know, that movie's more beloved by females than anybody else.
I don't know. I guess I gave off a weird vibe. So I don't know to tell you. it was a long time ago. But she, all right. So I don't know if this is true or not, if it just becomes one of those things that's on the internet. So then everybody just repeats it. It's over and over again. That the original script of Fear was that your character, your father, your biological father, was actually the dad, Reese Witherspoon's father, who had assaulted your biological mother in college, and that this was revenge. But that also meant that the revenge entailed you dating your half-sister, which is why people were like, no, this doesn't make any sense. You have this look on your face that none of this is true.
No, I never heard that before. No, the interesting story about that whole process was when I met the director. I'd made three movies, but none of them had come out. So I did Renaissance Man, I did Basketball Diaries, and I did, what was the other movie I did? They hadn't come out yet. And so when Jamie Foley had met Leonardo DiCaprio, you know, they were talking to Leo about playing that part. He was like, this is not really for me, but you got to meet this guy, Mark Wahlberg. And he was like, who's that? And he's like, all right, well, just, you know, the rapper Marky Mark. He's like, yeah. He's like, him. And he's like, what? Are you out of your mind? I said, he's not an actor. He said, no, I made a movie with him. He's really good. You should check him out. So just out of curiosity, he set up a meeting with me. We hung out in New York. We hit it off. I mean, we must have spent like 7-8 hours together. Met at a bar, hung out, had dinner. And by the time I got home, he called me and he was so apologetic. He was like, dude, I am so sorry. I want to be your friend, but I mean, I can't cast you in this movie. I said, dude, I only hung out with you because I really thought you were a funny, cool guy. I said, it's all good. Don't worry about it. You know, maybe we'll do something down the line. And then he felt bad. So he was like, he knew that there was these other parts of the kind of friends and, you know, the rest of the gang. So he was like, well, maybe I can give you one of these parts, but the parts are so small. Why don't you just, we'll audition you playing the lead because we can actually see what you can do. And so I went in and auditioned for the part. And then he literally said to me in the room, he goes, I'm going to tell the studio, if they don't hire you to be the star of this movie, then I'm not doing it. And I was like, okay, I guess, you know, if you want to put yourself on a limb like that. And that's how I got the part. But no connection to the dad being related and none of that stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. I was like, I could see how that was taken out of the script because it was kind of a weird comeback move. Be like, hey, I'm also dating my half-sister. Was it difficult? I mean, at that point, you're probably making money, so maybe it wasn't too expensive. But to get the Nicole Forever tattoo removed.
It wasn't a real tattoo. It wasn't a real tattoo.
All right. My research sucks on that one, too.
I had all my other tattoos removed. Yeah.
You did? So you've been asked about this, but I've never had the chance to sit down with you because with ESPN, it'd be so quick to turn and burn. Like, you have this music part of you that's so successful, but I would imagine deep down, you're much happier doing what you are doing now because like the return to music has never felt like something you want to do, right?
No. I mean, I think initially when I started in music, I was like, all right, this is what I'm doing. And then I was getting approached by people to be in movies and act, but I was just kind of like reluctant until I had that first experience with Penny Marshall and Danny DeVito. Once I had that experience, I was like, oh my God, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. I always had a love of cinema. My dad and I would go to the theater all the time. He'd introduce me to all the greats, Steve McQueen, Jimmy Cagney, John Garfield, Robert Ryan. I mean, I was a student of cinema, even though I never thought I would have an opportunity to make movies. So once I found it, I was like, this is what I'm going to do. I did continue to do music overseas and tour and stuff like that so I could, you know, make money to kind of fund my my pursuit of a film career. But I never planned on going back and making another record, putting it out, you know.
I know, like, even in sports, know, will get typecast. But like, all right, hey, he's good at this, but we never, ever want to see him do this. And then you're always feeling like the person that's in front of the camera, like, now you're wrong. And then, you know, the people that would work behind the camera tell me, you know, we're actually right way more often. And that's why we are the way we are. And you've had so many roles in on the producer side of things. Are you more understanding, or do you find yourself at times typecasting somebody like, hey, that person can't do that, realizing that's what everybody was saying about you decades ago?
I have. I mean, I certainly try to be more mindful of it because of my own experience and how that affected me, although it made me just more and more motivated and determined to prove people wrong. But the thing was that people, the expectations of me at the time were so low that it was like, if I did anything even remotely decent, then I was going to be applauded for it. And so, you know, that's kind of how I got my way in the door. But I, you know, I always try to give people the benefit of the doubt. You know, I remember when we were casting Entourage, it's like, you know, we brought in Kevin Dillon and we knew he was perfect for drama. And we thought him and Jeremy Piven were the only guys for those particular parts. And just because of that, the network insisted that we put him in the room or against like three or four other guys, which I felt uncomfortable about because, you know, we just knew that they were the guys, but they were able to still kind of show that it, despite the fact that other guys were going up for the same role.
So Boogie Nights, though, that had to be the thing that totally changed it.
Yeah. Yeah. That was, well, that was the time, you know, it was also for me as an actor, it was like, all right, I read the script and I thought this could be great, or this could be, you know, Showgirls had just come out and that was a disaster. It was kind of, you know, same kind of idea, pushing the envelope in a world that was a little risque. So when I decided to do it, I just felt like it was a real opportunity for me to play something that was unexpected, because I played the tough guy, the cool guy, and guys that my friends would, you know, applaud me for playing. And this could be something that could, you know, show me in a different light that was showing vulnerability. And, you know, so it was a bit of a risk, but I was willing to take that. I really wanted to commit as an actor and not worry about what everybody else thought.
But that's a really good point, because I remember being a loser in college and we rented Showgirls thinking like we were like being devious. Like, hey, you know, Tim's got Showgirls. He rented it. We're like, oh, okay. We're going to shut it down for the rest of the day. But, you know, you can read something, you can be pitched something, you can hear this idea and you go, and then it's falling apart, you know? And we're Boogie Nights. Like, I love that you just said that. You go, this could be really good. How does it happen? How does it happen from the moment of like inception, casting, and everybody, and then it just, these things can take two very divergent paths where one becomes praised and generational, like Boogie Nights, and other movies, you're like, look, it just didn't work. How does that happen?
I mean, look, it really just comes down to execution, right? It's hard to get a movie made, never mind how difficult it is to make a great movie. But I think you start with the level of talent that it attracted, and Paul Thomas Anderson's script, his talent as a director. He had already made Hard Eight, which was, you know, a small movie, but you definitely see greatness in it. And by the time I came on board, for me, it was weird because, you know, I'd already done the underwear thing and I'd done the Marky Mark thing. And it was like, I'd been in rooms with other people where they like literally just were like, okay, now it's time to take the underwear off. And I was like, I'm not, you know, what does that mean? But I read the first 30 pages of the script. I was like, oh my God, this could be great. Or this could be terrible. And I don't know, why does he want me? Does he think I can pull this part off? And then I met with him and then read the rest of the script. But, you know, you had De Niro at one point attached to playing Jack Horner. And then you had like Sidney Pollack. And it was just great people were always kind of hovering around. Sean Penn was attached to play the Alfred Molina role. It was always like really serious actors at one point or another flirting with playing various parts in the movie. So you knew it had potential. And then by that time, it was like, all right, we're going to take a swing. Let's just go for it. I had made another move with New Line and they were making the film. They were financing it. So I was like, let's just take a swing. No pun intended.
What were the scenes like with John C. Reilly? Like, they're my favorite scenes in the movie, when you guys are losing your shit and you're doing the music. And it's funny because you have a musical background. So it's almost like, you know, DiCaprio on purpose being bad in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Some people think that comp is a little too aggressive, but you having to be so out of touch, like, what were those moments like? Because I think Riley's as malleable as anybody going right now. Yeah. There has to be a funny story from that.
Oh gosh, there was many a funny story. I mean, every day we were just kind of, we would shoot what was on the page, and then we were doing a lot of riffing. You know, there was lots of improvising. Like when we were at the studio, we were just like going nuts on Robert Downey Sr. And I mean, it was just Michael Penn who played the engineer. It was like just tons of riffing and us pretending that we were all whacked out on blow. And, you know, and all the like the documentary stuff, like I do an interview and then John would be sitting there and be like, oh my God, he's tearing it up. I got to really one up this guy. And, but, you know, we were always really kind of pushing each other and challenging each other. And Paul was encouraging us to be as crazy as possible, which was great. And it was crazy because Paul and I were both 25 at the time. And, you know, there was no real studio interference or anything. We were kind of just left to our own devices. And it was a lot of fun. Those things were fantastic. Yeah.
Last thing here. Have you felt like you've done everything you wanted to do?
Absolutely not. I mean, there are days where I'm like, you know, the difficult thing is obviously the sacrifice that you make being away from your family, going off and being on location. Because most of the time I love making movies and I think I'm more excited about potential roles in the future. But it's the sacrifice they have to make being away from home. So what I love to continue to do lots of great things. So I have really cool stuff in the pipeline that is really unexpected. Absolutely. Am I going to make some of those movies? Yes. Am I going to get to make all of them? I don't know. I just made a movie called Father Stu, which I think is the best movie that I've ever been in. Financed it myself. It's coming out on Good Friday. The trailer's out, actually. You should check it out. And, you know, I've actually financed the movie myself. Like The Fighter, it's a true story. I had to get it made, really push it up a hill. But, you know, those movies kind of reinvigorate my excitement and my drive and desire to do more as an actor and as a producer, so, and a filmmaker. So I'm as fired up as I've ever been. I'm as hungry as I've ever been. And, you know, I think, you know, the best is yet to come.
Uncharted, February 18th, Mark Wahlberg. Thanks, man.
Thank you, bro. Appreciate it.
You want details? Bye. I drive a Ferrari. 355 Cabriolet. What's up? I have a ridiculous house in the South Fork. I have every toy you can possibly imagine. And best of all, kids, I am liquid. So, now you know what's possible. Let me tell you what's required.
Life advice is lifeadvicerr@gmail.com. We've had a lot of people following up on the lost LeBrons and what to do. It was overwhelming that people were like, take the shoes.
Shocker.
Which yes, it's really jumps in. I think that's just kind of where we're at. And again, I kind of knew the guy was going to take the shoes. I hope he emails in and tells us what he did. And then we had a couple people chime in that they lost shoes somewhere. So here's the thing. As much as I enjoy any participation, anybody that's engaged, you know, like, hey, let's get involved. I don't know that we're going to pivot this part of the podcast to a lost and found. So I could just see Simmons in a month going like, hey, are you doing anything different on the pod? I was looking at some of the numbers and be like, yeah, well, actually we're not doing life advice anymore. We're just doing lost and found at the end.
Trying to help people find their stuff.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. We just trying to pay it back. Pay it back. Just building a community here. Be like, oh, okay. Yeah. I would stop doing that. Okay. So we have a couple that I want to get to, but off of the Van Pelt story stuff, and there were a couple people that were there that heard the recap of some of the Van Pelt interactions, and they said you did a really nice job of being nice about everything that was happening. Poor Van Pelt, poor guy. So I'm going to present this one because then I had people, a couple chime, and one guy in particular was like, I wanted, because now guys are fascinated with the move of their open to somebody that is famous and how to handle it. So we get a lot of different people telling different stories about their interactions with famous people and they want a ruling on it. I don't know. Maybe that'll be a special. That could be a Fixed Baseball late July pod and how to handle. You sound like you want to jump in here, Sarudi.
No, I would just love to hear the success stories if there are any. I mean, I don't know how we could tell if they're true or not, but like if you cold asked a famous person, struck up a conversation, it worked out, and you guys hung out for a bit afterwards, I want to know about it.
Well, there's a guy who apparently ran into me and he wanted to know if he did a good job or if he did a bad job. All right. So, hey guys, 5'7", 170, short fit, decent size. Oh, okay. He's talking about his dick. Cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't think we need this.
You failed, buddy.
yeah. This is...
We definitely don't want that trend.
All right? Ever.
We don't. That's the only... If you do that now, we're not going to read the email. So, yeah. I'm the guy who bought Russillo with Sam Adams during Intermission to Kill a Mockingbird in New York City a couple years ago. I remember this. Part one of my question is about famous person etiquette. And again, I'm going to clarify to everybody, I know how little fame I actually have compared to people that are actually really famous because I've seen it and I've been with those people. So I, despite a healthy ego at times, I do think I keep myself in a relative, I like to be on Reality Island with a lot of the perception that I have of myself. Okay. All right. I thought Sarudi wanted to jump in, maybe add to that, but all right. Part one of the question is this. Ryan told a story on Monday's pod about people coming up to SVP after the Super Bowl and not passing the test. So I'm wondering how I handle our interaction at the play. I wanted to see To Kill a Mockingbird. Sorkin, I think, redid it. And then Jeff Daniels was in. It was terrific. I recognized Ryan instantly. He sat down next to me before the show started. I tried very hard not to overreact. I could hear my wife's voice in my head. Leave him the hell alone. He's just here to watch a play. Was I by myself? Yes. When the first act was over, nice. I was going to grab a beer from the concession. I was there working. I think I was still doing Get Up. So I would just shoot up and I would try to do stuff on certain nights. And considering you're getting up for Get Up, I'd be up so early.
Does that make you more approachable if you're like obviously by yourself? It's like, wow, you mean God probably, doesn't even have anybody to go with.
Probably
like,
not
of course
me.
He needs a beer. Yeah, maybe not.
Yeah, probably not me. But and then it's also a play. If you're in the play, it's like dark, you know, unless you see me rolling in ahead of time or whatever. All right. So when the first act was over, I was going to grab a beer from the concession anyway, so I figured, what the hell? When will I get another chance to buy Ryan Russillo a beer? I brought the beers back and handed one to Ryan, at which point it was now clear I knew who he was. I think you probably knew that ahead of time, but I told him I was a big fan of the pod. We shot the shit over a beer for a few minutes about sports, why he was in New York, and that he had seen Gruden downstairs on his way in. That's right. Gruden was at To Kill a Mockingbird. Ryan couldn't have been nicer. Second act started, play ended. We started to shuffle out, made conversation in that awkward, slow exit for like a second. I considered asking him if he wanted to grab a beer somewhere, quickly realizing there's no way he was likely to agree. I decided not to do that, and we went our separate ways. So did I do it right? If I didn't, what should I have done? And lastly, there's zero fucking chance Ryan would have taken me up on the beer offer, right? There's another part of this, too, where he was caught in a real conundrum. He goes, not sure if Ryan remembers, but he was seated at the end of the row and my seat was right next to him. There were two empty seats to my right and then a woman by herself. Ryan, me, empty woman. The seats were really small with very little leg room. And I thought of moving to my right to give us some more room when the show started. But you never know if people are going to arrive late, et cetera. But when intermission was over and the second act was about to start, these two seats were still empty. And so I moved one seat to my right, put an empty seat between me and Ryan. I remember this. It was awesome. I love that. That was my favorite part of the play. About 10 minutes into the second act, the folks in the row behind me leaned forward and asked me to move back because I was now blocking their view. So I was faced with a choice. One, move back next to Ryan and have him wonder what the fuck my story was. Two, move to the right next to the woman and have her wonder what the fuck my story was. Or stay put, force those folks to just deal. I elected for option three so as not to weird out Ryan or the lady and instead just slid down a little bit in my seat to try to block their view less. It wasn't super comfortable, but at least I didn't weird out my favorite podcast host or some random woman in the theater. What should I have done there? Well, I appreciate what you did. I didn't know you were dealing with. By the way, if you're 5'7 and they were freaked out because now you're blocking your view, there's no way you were blocking their view. Like they were psyched that they had the two empty seats in front of them, not realizing that the people in the row have empty seat priority over the people behind you. And if it were a normal full theater, because it was pretty packed, because it was a pretty big deal that this play was happening when it was happening, what do they expect? So, I'm sorry you were uncomfortable. All right. So anyway, yeah, I remember this guy was really nice. Grabbed me a beer. That was it. There's pretty much no chance I was going to go out with a stranger. I don't think I went out with anybody that I was friends with because when it comes to Get Up, that's just the last thing you're going to do. I think I was there for Get Up because I used to go back and do Get Up, I don't know, once every few months, which was kind of fun because I like to stay in the city for a week and then bounce and come back to LA or when I was still in Connecticut, I would come down. So yeah, I don't think there's a lot to add to this one, but yeah, I just wanted to let him know because he put so much time into this and he's still been thinking about it years later. Maybe this wasn't worth reading. I'm not sure now that I've read it out loud and spent this much time on it.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's a successful interaction, but it's not a successful, like you guys hit it off and wanted to hang out afterwards. Like that's what I'm looking for.
It would have been near impossible because I would have had to have wanted to do that. And I know that when I'm there during the week, I just, you know, I'm going to wake up at 4 a.m. and talk about sports. I probably didn't want to stay up till 10 and talk about sports. So there you go. All right. Let's get to some of these. Guy has a moving away party. I love the efficiency of this email. 29, 5'10", 175. Goofy athletic and could dunk before an ACL tear. That's awesome. I recently accepted a job that will have me moving multiple states away from the place I've lived for the last 10 years. I started telling my friends and naturally we're planning a going away party. But my friend who's organizing it wants to make it a going away party and a meet and greet for his new girlfriend. They just became Facebook official last week. Context, this guy hasn't had a girlfriend. I've been in a relationship for a couple of years. Are people still doing Facebook official?
I have no idea, bud. That's the one I cut it. I went off easy. I'm going to work on my way to get rid of the other ones, but Facebook was an easy drop, so I don't know.
So, Rudy, what's your status right now? It's complicated?
Wife and I are both on Facebook. We don't have an official, you know, we're married kind of thing. I remember back in the day, people would like jokingly do that. I don't think anybody took it. If you did take it seriously, you were kind of like frowned upon.
I thought It's Complicated was hilarious. That was my favorite one. It's like, what are you talking about? Why are you telling us?
Yeah, why are you airing out the fact that you're having relationship problems?
It's complicated. It's complicated is one of the greatest technology improvements. When I first was aware of what is, I'm like, wait, there's an option to say it's complicated.
If you're thinking about these DMs, go ahead, basically. Like, if you're thinking about it, you know, you might
open to other people. Yeah.
But then if it were the couple and both of them were like, it's complicated, it was a lock. Like, oh, you guys fight at happy hours in front of other people.
You just changed this, didn't you?
All right. So,
but what's weirder though? What's weirder? It's complicated. Or like back in the day when you used to poke people, like thinking like they got rid of that one pretty quickly. That was,
I think it's equal weird.
Yeah.
Cause I would have pokes from like all the girls I had crushed on and also my aunt. And it's like, wait, what's this list? What is this list?
Like, how'd you guys meet? He poked me.
He wouldn't stop.
Yeah. It was great. Just kept poking away. All right. Here we go.
He was persistent.
Was there a way to reciprocate? Did you have to poke back? I don't remember.
Yeah, you had to.
Oh, I thought you had to.
Yeah, I was very
short-lived. You could just leave it there, but you can't poke back.
I got rid of it as soon as like somebody else commented on what I did and it was a girl. And then the person I was with was like, what the fuck? And I was like, I can't control this. I can't control. And then she was like, say something. I'm like, argue with somebody on the wall for saying something nice about me. I was like, I'm out.
Should have had,
went to it's complicated. That's when you switch your relationship status.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So anyway, this guy is asking, is it weird that I'm annoyed that his friend who was going to throw him a going away party is semi-hijacking the going away party so that we can all meet his new girlfriend? My first thought is, why do you care? Like, who gives a shit, man? Now, if I'm fair to the emailer here in the question, I do think that even those of us, like, you know how there's that guy that like goes out of his way to make you know that he doesn't think anything is cool, right? Like, oh, I don't want to do that. Like, oh, you come to the reunion? Oh, no way, you know? But I think people, actually more people than not, enjoy a time where they're the center of attention. And it's like, no, we're doing this going away. So I can kind of understand, but as a guy, I don't think you're allowed to get that mad about it. And I definitely wouldn't say anything to him. So yeah, your feelings are okay. But like, what do you actually want to do? Do you want to tell him, no, it's not about her? All right. Like she's invited, but she can't be featured because I'm the main attraction. I think she how weird this
talk.
Is.
Yeah.
How do you feature somebody like that? Do you just like, excuse me before we get started? And then you like present her like a PowerPoint? Like, I don't understand.
Yeah. Why can't it just be your going away party? And then his new girlfriend is also there. I mean, it's probably weirder that your buddy who's hosting you the party was like, I'd like to kind of hybrid this deal and have this be an announcement to the community that I'm seeing somebody right now. So I get your annoyance. You know, I'm actually on the emailer side here a little bit, but I'm telling you, don't do anything. there's no like, hey, tell him this and then do this. No, I don't think that exists. I would just shut up about it and enjoy your party.
Yeah, it sounds like your buddy, he can't throw a normal party to introduce everyone to his new girlfriend. So he's like obviously using you to do that. It is kind of a shitty thing to do. I wouldn't personally care, but it's not quite at the level of like proposing at someone else's wedding. It's not that like much of a dick move. I don't know. I think you just kind of let it slide, and if it gets out of hand, maybe say a word or two to him, be like, "Hey, dude, calm down. This is my event." But like, let it happen, because if you don't let it happen, then you're kind of a dick.
Did you have a going away party, Surdy, from ESPN? Because ESPN used to, when somebody was going away, the ESPN going away party tour could be strong. You could be getting like a one good one a month, especially towards the end of my run there, because it felt like everybody was. But those are the kind of parties, you're a little bit younger in the ESPN social community. You lived for those things. You're like, wait,
yeah,
what are we doing? We going to a Vert, you know?
Yeah, we had a little bar taco deal.
We go to Cuvée, maybe little drinks and dancing after.
Yeah, we did the bar taco scene, couple drinks, couple bosses showed up. It was a good scene, but it was like the people that I would have wanted to be there. Like I don't even know if I invited that many people. It was like tight crew of like a dozen or so people.
I'm not a big attention guy. I don't want
that kind of stuff.
No, and I believe it with you. Did you go to mine across the street?
No. I don't think nice. So.
Did you go to yours, Ryan? I feel like maybe you didn't even go. I don't know.
I don't remember you having one. Did you have one?
No. What happened was after the last show, there were some people in the department that were like, we'd like to take you for dinner and drinks. And I was like, where?
Oh, at the Mexican place?
Yeah, across the street.
Yeah. Which is like, that restaurant changed like 100 times. Nothing ever stuck for like 6 months.
It used to be a McDonald's.
Yep.
And so yep. I went in. And I probably was like, yeah, I'll do it right after work. And then I was like, I probably want to work out, though. And then I think I had a beer. And then I was like, all right, see you guys. It was very anticlimactic. And I felt like some people showed up that maybe I didn't totally vibe with. It felt like they had to show up. And then I felt like I had it. And the person who organized it, very, very sweet person. And she was really thoughtful of her. So I don't want to sound like a total dick. But it was not going to be like a crew.
You weren't going to let it. You weren't going to let it be a thing.
Yeah, it wasn't going to be like an all, like, all right, we're doing it, folks. You know, I just kind of like in my own, like, hey, I'm out of here. And by that point, most of my close friends were already gone anyway. At least ones that I would have gone out with. So it wasn't going to happen. All right. Anything else on that? Kyle, you ever have a going away party?
The only one I had was when I moved out here to California. And we got all the New York City kids, all the Poughkeepsie kids got in the middle of a field and just fucking got after it. It was great. It was so good. They were like seeing deer. They were like, what the fuck was that? But they were, it was great. It was a good time.
All right.
There's still a couple beers from that, like in the deep recesses of my mom's garage fridge from like 2016.
A couple Keystones. I thought you had a field party post college or post high school. That was like always the like go to a parking lot somewhere and have a couple beers. Like, I don't think I ever did that post age 21.
Kyle, were you guys in the field being like, I can't believe you're gonna take over LA? Like,
no, what? They were like, I think they were like, well, when am I gonna come see you? I was like, buddy, I'm moving in with a girl who needs a roommate right now. I'm worried about how that's gonna go. I don't think you're allowed to tag along for at least a year, pal.
You were letting guys know immediately.
Yeah. Yeah.
35, 6 foot, 330, athlete. Yeah, you are. During a recent road trip, I got my fiance into your show by listening to old life advice segments. Thank you. During one of those segments about a guy's insecurity with dating taller women, my fiance tells me that when we take our engagement photos, she wants me to wear special shoes or shoe inserts to make me appear taller than her in the photos. As previously stated, I'm 6 foot tall and she is 5'11". Before the final words left her mouth, I refused, stating that I was already taller than her at 6 feet, to which she replied, I don't believe you. 2 years into this relationship, she was questioning if I was actually 6 feet tall. Hey, man, I know the feeling. As soon as we got home, my back was to the wall of a door frame. She measured me 5 feet, 11 inches and 1/2, no shoes. I explained that you always round up. and that I almost always wear shoes. I'm 6 foot tall walking around. Bro, you're way over 6 foot tall in shoes. Fucking, you're like Jack Reacher, just towering over
give me
people.
A break.
Have you guys watched Reacher yet?
No.
No.
The movie?
No, yeah. The TV show on Amazon.
Oh, no.
The guy's tall. They make tall references like he can fly. Like he's the only person that's ever been, and he's 6 foot five. Somebody goes, oh, he's 6 foot four. He's like 6 foot five. And then there's this other scene where he's checking into jail and they're like, we don't have anything that'll fit you except a circus tent. And it's like, dude, he's just a pretty big jack guy. Like, and he is.
Wait, is this one with Tom Cruise?
No, there's an Amazon series that's out.
Oh. Now.
Here's the plot.
But wasn't it Krasinski? Wasn't it Krasinski first, or was that a different guy?
No.
Tom Clancy.
That was
Krasinski's tall too. No, that's Jack Ryan.
Oh,
Jack Ryan. Yeah.
Sorry.
I can't believe I answered that one right.
Sorry.
He's tall too, but no, this Reacher show, which I'm sort of just enjoying because it's, I don't know, it's just a decent watch and I'm checking it out. The plot line is kind of like, Reacher, did you kill those people? No. Did you? Yes. Are you going to stop killing people? No. Are you? Probably not. Reacher, you need to stop killing everybody. Okay, I promise. Do you? No. There you go. There you go. Okay, so.
And scene.
But it's a fun
watch.
That's
a great review.
Yeah, I'm saying watch it. I'm saying watch it. But just, you know, it's not The Wire. All right. Let's get that out of the way. But yeah, he's 6'5 in the show. Apparently he's 6'2 in real life. And he's huge. I mean, he's kicking dudes' asses left and right. Don't get me wrong. But the way they talk about his height in that show, you would think there's never anybody who's been walking around that's ever been 6'5 in the history of people. All right, back to our guy. He's rounded up. He's 6 foot tall walking around. We're saying you're way over that in shoes. She measured 5'10". So wait, who's lying now? All right. Now, I don't feel like I'm insecure about my height. You shouldn't be, by the way. But I'm also aware that if I was an inch shorter, I would have never gotten a first date with my soon-to-be wife. But I'm not interested in wearing moon boots to our engagement photo so she can wear heels. I told her that she's the abnormally tall one.
Nice, dude.
No.
Fire back.
And that I want to wear my normal dress shoes, which have a little bit of heel anyway. We can't agree, so we want to let the life advice crew settle it. The shoot is on St. Paddy's Day. Your thoughts? All right.
Oof.
Just wear whatever she wants you to wear. It's the engagement photos. That's what I would do. I love everything you said. I'm happy for you. It's not like she's asking you to wear inserts or lifts the rest of your life. It's just for the engagement photos. She wants you to be taller than her. Do you want to be shorter than your wife in the engagement photos? Now, again, some people chime in. What's wrong with that? A ton is wrong with it. Okay. Not really, but I think if we all had a choice, but you do want to be taller than your wife in the engagement pictures, I just don't know how many people are checking the no box. I think it's a low number, if I'm just guessing. So if she's going to wear heels, like, this is just a picture. These are for her. What are you sending them to your buddies?
Wallet size.
Right. It's going to be in your house and she's going to make a ton. You're going to pay for a ton that you're never, ever going to use. And then maybe you use it for the save the date or whatever. I would just give in on this one. There's going to be so many other fights that you're going to get into when you're married. Just concede this one. And you know what? Maybe it's a chip later on, you know, when you decide to do an addition by yourself to save money. And she's like, I don't like that idea. And he goes, hey, I wore your moon boots for the engagement photos.
Hold it over her head forever.
Forever. So that's what I think. I think she just did you a favor. So Rudy?
I think there's a compromise here. You can wear the shoes you want, and they make those like gel insoles that add like an inch to you that you could put in regular shoes. So just wear those. And I actually think she's kind of right. Even if she's being a little bit of a dick about it, like, do you want to be shorter than her in these pictures too? Think about that. Like, everyone's going to see this. And what's the first thing they're going to say? Oh my God, she's taller than him. Is that weird? And I'm not saying it is weird because we just talked about that, but I think you're actually doing yourself a favor. If you just do the insole thing, wear the shoes you want to do, then you're an inch taller than her. And then everything's fine. Everybody's happy.
The other problem is because you're 330, people don't realize how tall you are, right? If you were, it's just the way it works. You know, when you're thinner, you look taller and you're a thick dude, but you're an athlete as well. But maybe the bigger issue is that she never believed him and they had to go home immediately and check the tape. And I don't mean, have a problem.
She's technically right, though.
Oh, Cerruti. Come on.
I know you do round up. I know you do round up. But his thing of like, unless you're a basketball player or like at the NFL combine, no, you don't get measured in shoes. Like, I know my height not with shoes. I'm 5'10". I'm a true 5'10". I don't round up. I don't round up to 5'11". I'm 5'10". But I don't also put on like, you know, like a pair of Clarks to add an inch to my height and say I'm 5'11". I don't think that's realistic. I don't think that's fair.
When I was at ESPN Radio in the early days, I had never met more guys that claimed 6 feet that weren't. Now, Greeny, Golic, tall guys, Cowherd's tall. I'm all right. Van Pelt's tall. But then there were other guys that were definitely not tall that were like, yeah, I'm 6 feet. And I was like, I think you're in that 5'10 range. But I'm not marrying any of those guys, and I'm not standing next to them in an engagement photo. So none of that's even that relevant. I think him saying 5'11 and a half going to 6 feet, I think that's fine. But that might be the bigger issue. That might be the bigger issue.
You could always claim shrinkage, too.
Yeah. Squats.
It's got a lot of pressure on my tailbone and spine. And, you know, we'll get it worked out one day. But for right now, it's 5'11 and a half.
So what did we rule here? What were the votes? I say just do it. Get it over with.
So I think you do it, too. Yeah.
Right. My initial thing was going to be no, but you talked me into it. Yeah, that's fine. It's one time.
Yeah, there are better fights. There are better fights, as we say often. Okay, hope you enjoyed that. Please subscribe. Ryan Russillo Podcast, Spotify, Ringer. Thanks to Steve and Kyle. Back on Friday.